This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. Here we are at episode number 10. We've made it to double digits. Can't believe it. Anyway, I want to thank everybody who's been listening and being supportive and sending me notes, asking for stickers. I really appreciate it. It's a lot of fun to get your messages. And if you have requested them, they are on their way, I promise. So if you would like some Radical Therapist, while I'm on the subject, if you'd like some Radical Therapist stickers, please just email me, theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. Go to the website, theradicaltherapist.com. Shoot me a message through Twitter at the Rad Therapist or my Instagram site at the Radical Therapist, and I will get you some stickers. So please don't hesitate to ask. Anyway, we're at episode number 10, and I'm excited today because we are going to be talking about, well, we're moving into the world of tech, which I'm excited about. Specifically, we're going to be talking about, well, a couple of things, cyborg anthropology and also comm technology with Amber Case. I think you'll find this to be a fascinating conversation. Cyborg anthropology takes the view that most of modern human life is a product of both human and non-human objects, and how we interact with machines and technologies in many ways defines who we are. So cyborg anthropology is the framework for understanding the effects of objects and technology on humans and culture. And Amber Case is going to walk us through cyborg anthropology. And she's also going to talk to us about comm technology, another aspect of technology that she's really interested. She's interested because of her work, I'm assuming because of her work around cyborg anthropology. She's interested in how to make these devices that are all part of our lives and simplify them and simplify the complexities and not introduce new ones and not add feature after feature after feature, but maybe go kind of the opposite direction towards a comm technology that rather than panicking us would help us focus on things that were really important to us. So we're going to talk about that and a lot of other stuff in the show today. So please stay tuned. A little bit about Amber Case. If you don't already know who she is an entrepreneur and researcher helping Fortune 500 companies design and build and think about connected devices. I first learned about her through her TED Talk. She did a very popular TED Talk called We Are All Cyborgs Now, and it's been viewed by over a million people at this time. And she's been named one of National Geographic's Emerging Explorers. She's been listed among Inc. Magazine's 30 Under 30 and featured among Fast Company's most influential women in technology. So she has quite the resume. She also is an author. She is the author of an illustrated dictionary of cyborg anthropology. And now, and what we're going to talk about today is her new book, which is on pre-release at O'Reilly Books, but also you can pre-order on Amazon. It is titled Designing Comm Technology. She's a passionate advocate for privacy and the future of data ownership and is interested in furthering the ideas of comm technology, wearable computing, and the future of interface. And her current work is she's serving as managing director of existence at HealthWaves, which involves predictive analysis and wellness, always up to interesting stuff. And she currently lives in, works in Portland, Oregon. So I think you're going to find our conversation very interesting. We cover a lot of topics. And so without further ado, let's get to the conversation. Well, welcome to the show, Amber.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Yes, I really appreciate you taking the time. I think the listeners of the Radical Therapist podcast are really going to enjoy the work that you're doing. So I really want to thank you. I know you're very busy for taking this time, and I'll try not to take too much of it. But I thought I would start by kind of talking about how I came to know your work. And I became really interested. I'm a family therapist by trade. So I was very influenced by cybernetic theory and then systems theory and in my training. And I thought, you know, that was very interesting, but it was kind of embedded in a time of the 60s and 70s. And I was trained, you know, well after that. So I was noticing that things were kind of different, right? That we were being, you know, this was the age of technology and machines. And I didn't really see, and systems theory tends to be very human-centered. And then I discovered the work of Bruno Latour and his actor network theory, which I think gives equal weight to non-human, what he calls actors or actants, and which was really interesting to me as a therapist, because I would work with people and sometimes their most influential person in their life was like a cartoon character or somebody from literature or something like that. And it was a very real relationship. So I was looking for, and, you know, technology, of course, was influencing everybody's lives, especially with working with couples. And sometimes infidelity in tech, which is a whole nother story or subject matter. But so all these things were kind of going on all at the same time. And I discovered Bruno Latour and discovered his actor network theory. And I thought it was very kind of systems theory on steroids. And it fit for me. And I became very interested in it. And then somehow I got introduced to your work in cyborg anthropology. And I'm imagining it's through your very popular TED Talk. And ever since then, I've been following your work. I follow you on Instagram and some of these other things. And I've always been kind of paying attention to what you're up to. And it's always very fascinating. So I really appreciate you being here. But I guess my first question is, you know, that was kind of how I came to know it, but I was wondering how you came into cyborg anthropology or looking at the world in these kinds of different ways.
Sure. Well, I was really interested in technology as a kid. I grew up with an Atari computer. My dad got one at the same time he heard that my mom was pregnant with me. So I grew up with it as if it were the family dog.
Wow.
When the computer died and did a memory check over and over again after being stored in a garage for a couple of years, it was my first experience of death. My first experience of death has been with electronics, not with people. You know, my grandfather died and I was very upset about that, but I didn't see him die. You know, I was 4 years old. I heard about it in stories. But when the Atari computer died, I saw it die. I had a tape recorder and it started to break on me, and I would fix it as much as I could. And when that finally died, I buried it in the backyard and gave it a funeral. So my relationship with technology was very, very, very intertwined with my idea of life and death. You know, when you're a little kid, often you have stuffed animals and Legos that have their own characters and personalities, and you go through all of these situations with them where they're alive and they're interacting.
But a
piece of technology interacts with you as if it's alive too, right? And especially my tape recorder, I was an only child. One of the ways that I kept myself company was to record into the tape recorder. The tape recorder was, as Donna Haraway would call it, my non-human ally. And it was an actor on the actor network of things in my life. It helped me in a feedback loop shape my identity. So I was obsessed with technology. I thought it was really fun. I loved mathematics. I loved science. I kept getting into science and technology programs by accident. I didn't really know anybody. I was growing up in suburban Denver, Colorado. I didn't really know anybody around me that was into science and technology. I was the only person. I also didn't understand gender very well. So I kind of grew up in this very non-gendered space of just being a nerd that has some identity outside of male or female. I was the weirdo. I got really excited about that. I got to learn all of these different systems and things and made my own websites and things at 13. I got my first job at 14 for the mayor of Denver doing websites in the dot-com boom.
Wow.
That was amazing. And then I really wanted to go to Caltech or MIT. And I told my mom this, and my mom said, well, let me talk to my best friend, who's a math professor in Minneapolis, and see what she has to say. So she called her up. She said, look, you do not need to go into mathematics or technology. You need to understand how the world works, because it will change on you. And if you work for a company like Lockheed Martin, maybe everybody will be laid off, and you won't have a job, but you won't know why, and you won't know how to take charge of your own reality. Mm. Why don't you go to a private liberal arts college and learn how to think? Because anything the world throws at you, you'll be able to deal with. So I found a liberal arts college called Lewis and Clark College, and I found...
Yes, I know it well.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Within the first 5 days of going to classes there, I kind of just randomly grabbed like a grab bag of non-technical classes to take. Sociology being the first one, history, communications, and a class called Inventing America, which is all about the advertising and PR about how America got a bunch of people to till the land and make it reasonable as a place to live early on. So I took these classes, and I remember the first day of sociology class learning that you could have a framework for understanding society. And I said, that's it. That's what I want to do. 5 days in, I had my double major of sociology, anthropology, and that was it. At the end of that semester, I went to a philosophy colloquium, and this teacher, Deborah Heath, who was friends with Donna Haraway, showed up and said, I'm going to talk about cyborg anthropology, it's the interaction between humans and technology, how technology affects culture. We think of technology as an actor on an actor network instead of just humans. We think of our tools, you know, technology is another tool that's evolved over time with us, co-created us, co-produced us. And this is what this is about. And I said, that's it. That's who I am. It's the perfect blending of the two things I care about, which is understanding people and societies and understanding technology. And I said, that's what I want to major in. I wrote my thesis on mobile phones. And then I asked her, can I do something with this field? Because people aren't writing about it enough. And you know, technology and especially mobile phones are going to become very important in the future. And she said, yeah, go ahead. So then I later got invited to speak at TED, and I worked a lot in technology just trying to, I wouldn't say humanize technology, because as Mark Weiser, who is kind of the father of ubiquitous computing, said, we don't need smarter devices, we need smarter people. Mm. I think that technology is an aid and a tool, just as it was before, but we are trying to imbue this technology with so many human pieces that we're in danger of losing a lot of our humanity in the process. Yeah, it's symbiotic. It doesn't, one erodes the other, you know, if you do it wrong.
Interesting. Yeah. And that is a nice lead into my next question, because I think there's an idea, and maybe I'm wrong, and just, you know, there's just this idea that the average person is not aware of how much their life is changing or being changed by tech, and that maybe there's this kind of thing we're taking it for granted and maybe not becoming smarter in some ways. I mean, do you have any ideas about that or thoughts about that?
Absolutely. I mean, there's that story about the two young fish in the river, and the older fish swims by and says, how's the water? And the two fish don't know what water is.
Right.
And there's also that book, you know, there's Future Shock by Alvin Toffler, and the new book by Douglas Rushkoff called Present Shock. And that's all about the future is happening so quick that we can't attune to it. And now with Rushkoff's book, the present is happening so quickly we can't attune to it either. Why I think anthropology is important is that you can step outside, try to be kind of objective, and look at people as if they're kind of the anthropological other. And the reason why I wanted to do my research in the United States, kind of in the first world of technology, so to speak, is that, number one, I didn't come from a social class where I could just fly over to another country on the drop of a dime and study people as if they were the other, right? Because traditional anthropologists go to field sites in other places and they say, oh, these people are different from us, right? They use different tools. They have different kinships. In cyborg anthropology, you just look at your own phone and you say, what's my relationship to this technology and how does that change me? And because this is considered the norm, everybody, you know, no one steps back and says, well, how's this changing us, right? And I think it's really, really important to understand that most people now are waking up with their devices and they're going to sleep with the devices.
Yeah, for sure.
And so one of the things in my thesis and one of the things in my early research was the history of the telephone. Right. So when the telephone first came out, people were very concerned that we'd have a kind of schizophrenia where we would lock ourselves in rooms and never come out. Right. But the phone was a way to connect with people who were far away and also organize social events and get information across. It was a placeholder for when you couldn't be in a place with someone and it was planning those face-to-face interactions. Now we have a society that instead of, you know, large family groups living together like we had in the early, you know, last century, we have people living in the equivalent of what I just call pods, right? There's a reason why podcasts are becoming more popular. There's a reason why iPods are popular. We have these small condos. We have these small houses. Oftentimes you have people who are single moving into cities. You have less and less people having giant families. You don't have grandparents living with people anymore.
No.
And so to replace that, you know, these families that are now moving around to take different jobs where there's opportunity, we use digital devices. Yeah. We don't have a street full of kids that are playing with each other. In fact, kids aren't really allowed out on the street late at night anymore. You don't just get called back down from the mountain after, you know, to get some dinner, right? So in this case, you have people communicating with each other through the phone. And that phone becomes the placeholder for the socialization. But there's issues, right? Like, one of the issues is that when people are tired and they really need a nap, they tend to kind of cyberloaf, right? They should really be taking a nap, you know, 3 to 5 p.m. In other countries, we have the same thing going on, right? Like, we have people get tired around a certain time of day. And they usually take a nap or a siesta or they take a long lunch.
Yeah.
But in America, we never have that break. We're expected to keep going. In a classroom, you leave school at 3 p.m., which is the right time to leave. And then, you know, you hang out a little bit or you have an after school activity and then you go home and you do some homework. But in the standard business world, you don't. And so you end up having people not really being that productive and then just like consuming articles online. So I think there's this kind of unhealthy addiction that we have to phones where you have instant gratification. And you're also seeing things, and it seems like they're built almost instantaneously when they're not. You're not seeing the means of production behind things. You're just getting an instant button that gives you a dopamine hit. And I think that's, you know, that's like B.F. Skinner's intermittent reinforcement experiment with the mice pressing the button.
Right.
And randomly, you get some food. Randomly, we check our emails, and sometimes we get mail, and sometimes we don't.
That's a really interesting point, that the production behind. I'm wondering, what are the trends now in cyborg anthropology? What are people looking at? Is that one aspect, or where do you think the future, or what are some of the themes that are coming out currently?
Sure. Well, some of the things I've seen in cyborg anthropology are reproduction, right? Reproduction as a result of, you know, the cyborg state. You do not naturally have a child. You go into a scientific industrial complex building where under bright lights and absolutely sanitary conditions, you may or may not have a C-section and deliver your child. Hmm. You're able to see fourth dimensionally inside your own stomach before you have the child.
Yeah.
You're able to tell whether it's healthy or not. You have all sorts of random vitamins that you take. You know, this is amazing, right?
Right?
And that's the norm, right? The new norm is to have a child that way, right? You have lots of control. There's fertility drugs. So we have cyborg babies, right? So that's one of the subjects that cyborg anthropology has been applied to. My professor was one of two anthropologists on the Human Genome Project, watching networks of science, right? Where does the information come from? Who holds the information? How does it get produced? Who does it get shared with? Right. So there's the kind of information type thing. And if you extend that into the future, it's all about what's our identity online? Where does it start and where does it stop? You know, Maureen McHugh had the book, I think it was Naturally Born Cyborgs. We have Sherry Turkle releasing a new book. One of the compendiums she edited was about the inner history of devices, which was people finding old phones in drawers and remembering an entire relationship based on that phone, right? That becomes an object that's a placeholder for a person. We have people looking at privacy and security. And my favorite book that I like to kind of read as a companion when I look at this stuff is Liquid Modernity by Zygmunt Bauman.
Yes, I actually have that book.
It's an incredibly good book because it talks about, you know, he has these kind of vignettes on liquid life, liquid tech, and liquid identity. But liquid modernity is all about how technology changes and how postmodernity changes identity, work, play, and I think two other aspects. It's just like a 5-chapter book, but it's very concise in the way that it shows how these things are shaped, right? Because the software company that I started was all about taking the concepts of Marshall Berman's book, All That Is Solid Melts Into Air, which is, first we had these buttons that were physical, and you had to rewire them in order to change what they did. And now we have liquid interfaces on a screen where the button can be anywhere. So the next generation of the button is in the air, that you walk into the button, right? Mm. So along with Zygmunt Bauman, like, what does this mean, right? And along with the history of the landline phone, we had the landline phone, and that was restrained and restricted to a house, right? What does that mean? That means that you can walk around within your own house within this corded line and talk to people, right? You have 1.5 people with you, right? Like kind of half of a persona and identity. But then we got the cordless phone detached from the wire, and that allowed us to go even further. You know, maybe you could go outside on your cordless phone. And once we had the cell phone, suddenly that thing was untethered, and we got this space that was formerly restricted to a building, to a room, to a focus space, and that could come with us anywhere. And now I kind of think of cell phones as the new cigarettes. Like, you are a completed person if you are you plus your phone, right?
Right.
You can sit next to somebody on a bus and take up more than just your space if you're talking to somebody on the phone. And this is really important to think about, because this is something that has become the norm. And so we don't think of ourselves now as, for instance, hoarding information, right? Like, a hoarder fills up a room with newspapers and cats. Stereotypically, right? And a person online may do the same thing, hoarding news articles, hoarding pictures. And unlike our stomachs, which tell us when we're full, our brains don't have that switch that says, hey, you're full. You've engorged on information.
Wow.
And so if you have people who are depressive and don't have enough good experiences and feel stuck, they often find themselves in these repetitive loops. And as somebody who's suffered from depression and struggled with it since a very early age, I understand what patterns happen to myself when I get into those states. I become addicted to this push button interface on the phone.
Right.
One of my friends who's a visual artist, his name is Coven. He lives in Boston. He gave a talk recently at a conference called And Yet about how when we're on our phone all the time, we're reduced to an eye and a finger, right? That our entire world and our senses are eyes and, you know, your index finger, where you're just scrolling and looking. And that kind of accretion layer inside your own human operating system can kind of screw with you, right? If you think of just dumping things into a computer, and early on you had this idea of computer defragmentation, right? Like, you need to have more space in your computer, so it defragments. I always think of, like, when you go to sleep and you have REM cycle, it's kind of the equivalent, right? It's, we make our computers in the shape of us. There is a sleep cycle that happens, and then you go to sleep, and then your system through dreams kind of defragments and compresses things together, and then you wake up with a clean operating system, right? But if you're just storing all this stuff and it's not being embodied, right? Let's say I go on a Wikipedia binge, but I haven't had the experiences of, you know, a biology lab that I'm actually reading about. When I go to sleep, my brain just kind of dumps it, right? We can hoard this information. It feels really good. It feels really new. But in the end, it just gets dumped out, right?
Right.
And that I just don't think that's very healthy, for instance. But it sure is fun in the moment. And So I think there's all these things going on, but it's okay now to be hoarders. It's okay to be addicted to devices, because if everybody is, it's not a problem, right?
Yeah, right. And well, and that was, you had me thinking that, like, characterizing it as an addiction. And maybe this is the time to kind of talk about or move into talking about comm technology. And I came across an article when I knew that I was going to be talking to you titled Constantly Connected, The Effects of Smart Devices on Mental Health. And this is 2014 out of the journal Computers and Human Behavior. And it's very recent. And this is the first study, according to the authors, to examine the association between smart devices and mental health, specifically depression, anxiety, and stress. And they discovered that their findings had suggested that the nature of the relationship a person has with their smart device is more predictive of depression and stress rather than the extent of use. And I think that might kind of go counter to some ideas out there that we're using it so much, but I like what you're doing with comm technology because it's about the relationship with tech, right? And so do you have any thoughts about that? About, because I kind of think that you're like, you know, I was jotting some notes that you're interested, you're a radical therapist for the Internet of Things, right? You're interested in you're interested in improving our relationships with devices. And but you're up against that, I think, in your first principle of comm technology, this idea that technology should require the smallest amount of our attention. Does that seem like a tall order at this time after kind of what you just described?
Oh, absolutely. First off, that paper is great. It doesn't even matter the content of the paper. Right. It matters that people are researching this and that there may be a variety of papers. And I really like the idea of looking at the relationship with the device and then telling about how somebody is versus saying this causes depression, right?
Right.
Because the thing is, I think technology itself, I feel, is quite neutral, but it depends on how you use it, right? And how it's scripted, right? If there is an application that interrupts you constantly, like Candy Crush Saga or Farmville or anything like that, and it makes these unnecessary demands on your attention, and if you're depressed, you're probably more likely to care about those things, right? And if you're not depressed, you might have a little bit more fortitude and not want to use those programs as much. I've watched myself get super depressed and sick in bed. And I found that if I do Farmville or some of these applications, I get this miniature sense of accomplishment that I can't get in the real world because I'm depressed or sick. And that I'm willing to pay $40 for those random items in the game, right? Because it's one of the only things I can do when I'm in bed, right? But the device itself is not making me depressed. The my depressive state is causing me to consume differently on the device, right? When I'm not depressed at all, I don't need to use my device in the morning. I don't feel this crazy hunger as if it's a cigarette that I absolutely need to get this information off of the device. So regardless of how these papers turn out, the fact that people are starting to really research this is important. But there's also been a lot of research in the past on this. It's just not been called mobile phones. You know, it's computer addiction and things like that.
Right.
But if this person says, this is the first paper, that's nice. It's not. but it's a great idea to get people excited about this because we do need to research the kind of symbiotic, kind of cybernetic feedback loop that can happen. Where if I'm depressed and then I use the technology and then it causes me to get more depressed and then I get addicted and I get stuck. Then that's important. How do I get out of that feedback loop? Right. So I think like there's a lot of really interesting things going on with these devices and how people are using these devices. But my favorite is, you know, in the dot-com boom, a lot of people were using technology as a tool to create things. I like to look at how our computers were set up then too. We didn't have a lot of mobile devices. We had some Palm Pilots, right? And in the 80s and 90s, we had the Xerox PARC tab. You know, we had early mobile technologies then too, but they were used by a few people. But we had desktop computers where the screen was something that we looked up at or looked directly ahead of, and then we would sit at a desktop. And that was great because we could build something over time, right? And that allowed us to, you know, maybe sit up straight a little bit better and have better blood flow to our brains. And so the way that we interacted with technology was a little bit differently. Also, we had, in some cases, far faster internet access because there weren't a lot of people clogging the pipes. We didn't have Netflix, you know, streaming all this information. I remember having a very fast internet connection that was wireless in the late 90s, actually, at my house. My dad and I drilled through the side of the house to get that internet connection so that we could like put little wireless nodules everywhere. But we did have a really fast internet. And but then I realized as we got into laptops and got more mobile, we could compute anywhere. And people started to arch their necks down, and they started to consume a lot more. The same with phones. Like, now people are bent over with their neck in this horrible posture.
For sure.
And they're consuming. If you look at BlackBerries, that compressed a lot of the information in the phone. So you'd have really cheap international data rates and really good security. So you'd find that people would use it as a work phone. They wouldn't be browsing because the browser was awful and super slow, because the internet's not made for, you know, slow mobile browsing that's compressed. But they were able to get a lot of emails done. So the shape of that device and how it interacted with data affected how people used it, and also changed people's brains. Like, you can find a BlackBerry type person, and their persona is different than somebody who used a Palm or a Windows mobile device, or, you know, Macs and PCs now. It's kind of the same as finding people who, you know, write in the Ruby programming languages versus Python or Objective-C or Go, right? I used to be really good at this, but I'd just sit there in Silicon Valley and I'd be like, that person is a C developer, that person's a Python developer, that person's a PHP developer. PHP developers were incredibly easy to spot, which was really fantastic. But you kind of see that how you consume media and what you consume shapes your brain, and also kind of shapes your interactions and you know, a lot of that. So now I'm trying to go back to the desktop because I want to use my computer as a tool. I want to do projects that take a lot of time. And this brings us back to your question on calm technology. Which, you know, Mark Weiser said in a paper with John C. LeBrown, he said, the world is not a desktop. With ubiquitous computing, or Internet of Things as we now know it, we can't interact with our environment in the same way we would a desktop. We can't sit there in front of it and draw all of our attention to it. And so we need to have things that don't take all of our attention. A desktop, you can take all of somebody's attention. It's no big deal because there's nothing else to distract them. That is their primary focus. But when you're trying to get somebody's attention from an app in a supermarket checkout, and the app is too big and it takes too long to download, or it interrupts somebody with some meaningless piece of information when they're driving in a car, you're driving or you're in the checkout line, those are your primary focuses of attention, not your phone. And so you need to compress that information into a secondary or tertiary notifier so that you can get the information across without distracting the person from their primary focus, right? So in a car setup, your primary attention is on the road and on looking around you. Your secondary attention can be to glance into your rear view window or your side mirror to see if somebody is approaching. And maybe your tertiary task is the radio station, right?
Or a podcast.
Or a podcast, yes. And the other thing is, you don't need to see the pedals to use them. You don't need to look at them. And it's really important to note that, like, a car is meant for that sort of primary focus task. But when a phone sends you a message when you're in the car and you've loaded up all those environmental variables to drive, about all that calculus about how far away you are from the car and when you need to stop, and you glance down at your phone, you're dropping those environmental variables. You are switching them out for another primary task, which is looking at your phone and reading what's on there. And then by the time you switch back up and reload those environmental variables, you can get in a car accident. And so the idea of calm technology is, once we get all these embedded devices, they're going to start taking our attention, because every time we switch platforms, people keep programming for the older platform. People are programming for desktop, even though it's mobile, right? And Apple Watch apps and lots of watch apps don't make any sense because of that. It's like, if you're going to have a watch app, it needs to be black and white or grayscale. It needs to last forever. And it needs to give you the minimum amount of information that you need. Number one, the time. Number two, emergency alerts. Number three, whatever you subscribe to, you know, you can do a lot more with different senses. I mean, calm technology is about compressing that information into different senses, like the sense of sound, right? You can have a ringtone that has a different sound for a different type of person, or a text message notification. If you have a pacemaker or an insulin pump, don't make it beep. That will have other people hear it. You know, a buzz is a personal notification, right? It's close to you. So, you know, the idea behind these concepts is use the least amount of attention possible so that you don't distract somebody out of their daily life. Make smarter humans, not smarter technology. Mm. Use the full range of human senses instead of just the visual sense, and allow people to be human. Don't try to make technology that's human, or you'll turn people into acting like robots. You know, technology can communicate but doesn't need to speak. You don't need to have a disembodied voice tell you something. You can just have a status light, like a record button on a video camera.
Yeah, and you have two great examples of the tea kettle and the lavatory sign on your website as examples of this kind of notification.
Yeah, the tea kettle is something that you set, you forget, you go to another room, and when it's done, it calls to you, right?
Yes,
it
yes.
gives you a status shout. That's a perfect example of calm technology. It works in your periphery, uses your peripheral attention, and then puts your focus to primary when necessary. But the thing is, it's boring, right? The best technology, it's invisible. The best technology is invisible. It gets out of the way and lets you live your life, right? But invisible doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It doesn't mean there's no interface. There's a lot of people who are like, it's no interface. No. There's interfaces, but they get it out of your way when you are not using them. So the technology that we see as mundane, right? The technology we no longer notice. Electricity. It's there when you need it, not when you don't. And the only time we notice it is when it fails, right? When it's not working.
Right.
The same with the tea kettle, with a laundry machine that's done well, with our cars. You know, these are the things that we use that we just don't really notice because they're part of our lives. And technology keeps getting in our way. You know, why would you have an Apple TV when you turn it on tell you to download an update? Why wouldn't it have you download the update before you shut it off? On the new Windows 10, it says download updates and turn off as one of the options. That's great. When I'm done using the device, I would like to download an update. I do not want to download an update when I turn on the computer or when I turn on the Apple TV. I want to watch a television show.
So true.
Right? Yeah, so true. Don't get in the way of me being human and doing what I want to do. Have it be bundled into an action that involves me turning it off.
Yeah, that's such a perfect example because I'm always in the middle of something and it pops up and tells me it wants me to do something and then I have to usually restart or something. And it's just not going to happen. So,
right.
Very obtrusive, which, you know, we're in a world, and you mentioned this, we're in a world of like feature after feature after feature. And you're speaking of like more elegance, humanity, and kind of unobtrusiveness. How do you think that's going to shift? Or, I mean, what is the task at hand, or what's the heavy lifting do you think that has to happen to kind of move from that? We've been so prone to feature after feature after feature to move. I really like that elegant, humane, unobtrusive philosophy of yours.
Well, it's really funny. I mean, right now with business models centered around advertising and kind of flipped monetary models, it makes sense to distract people and get them back into your app as much as possible, right? Because that increases advertising revenue. When advertising is less of an important model, when the tech boom dies out a little bit, we will need to focus on really good user experience. I love, for instance, Windows 10. They got back all of the insights that they had in previous versions. You know, we had Windows 7 that was really good, and then Windows 8 and 9 were horrific. And I refused to use Microsoft products while waiting for them to come back to their senses. And it wasn't that they had bad senses to begin with. They decided to re-architect, this kind of flat design experience with Metro. And they made a lot of mistakes, but they allowed themselves to make a lot of mistakes. And, you know, they bought a number of different companies during that time, like Yammer and Skype. And that really helped out the user experience, right? Mm. But they've always been really good at researching how to make people productive and what interfaces to put where. And I think they're doing a really, really good job. Whereas Apple is becoming more and more like Microsoft was before. All of these random things that open up when you open up your laptop that get in the way of doing your work,
so
right?
So true, yeah.
And I think that there's always these shifts. To give a negative dystopian opinion, which I hope is not going to be true, we'll see technology be there based on social status, right? So if you are of a low social status and you can't afford new technology, your ill-fitting prosthetics, as Sigmund Freud said in his book Civilization and Its Discontents, will turn against you. Yeah, right. Which is one of my favorite quotes of his, where he talked about this future in which if you didn't upgrade to certain products, I'm loosely interpreting what he said, those interfaces will turn against you and cause your life to be hell, right?
Yeah, right.
And I think it's really important to notice that when you don't buy the nice system or you're not middle class enough to afford a better lifestyle, which ends up being like more Buddhist and filled with yoga and things like that, you don't get this nice, flowy reality. You get all these things interrupting you constantly. Mm. I don't think that's going to be the case, because what we'll have is waves. We'll have waves where there's too much information, and then there'll be waves where things are calmed down, and then there'll be waves of too much information. I mean, you see it on the web, right? You had the web where it was egalitarian and friendly, and everybody had a great time, and they all hung out with each other regardless of their background, and they had these in real life meetups, and Howard Rheingold was a part of all of that, you know, and early Doug Rushkoff, and it was really great. And now you have the Salem witch trials version of the web, where everybody, you know, might say something in jest or not and get completely publicly humiliated to the point where like people will show up at your house and try and kill you.
Yeah, it's pretty treacherous out there.
It's very treacherous, right? Because we're in kind of this weird global micro singularity moment where every once in a while we get a micro singularity where everybody turns their eye of Sauron onto a person and decides.
Great description.
They decide whether the person is okay or not. The eternal judgment from the masses. That freaks me out personally. But it's just a stage of the web, and we'll get through it. We'll have another stage, and then we'll have a closed
message. Yeah, I like your message of hope.
Right, because you know, and I've been through enough of the web, right? Whatever. But I've been through a lot of the web, and also talking to a lot of people who are on, you know, bulletin board forums, 1978, who talk about the difference between, you know, spaces, and right now how the space of the web is constructed is. You are reduced, your creativity on most social networks is reduced to a little box, right? Here is your box to express yourself. Here is your templated self, right? Mm. Whereas on sites like GeoCities, you would create yourself and you would have some weird random looking website, right? People would create with HTML the weirdest things possible.
Yeah, you're bringing me back right now.
Right? But that was freedom. Like that was Web 1.0. You're the artist and here's your canvas and you can do whatever the heck you want, right? And you're seeing this, again, very, very small in this new website that's trying to remake GeoCities called NeoCities. You're seeing lots of artists flock to the site and make weird things, right? And weird genres of music and stuff like that, which is really neat, you know, like Vaporwave, which is a new genre of music, which you can look up yourself.
I'm going to, thank you.
But, you know, you often see in a tech boom, people get pretty standardized, right? They get pretty bland, and they're all about repeating the business success so that they can go forward. And you can't take a lot of risks in this era. You can take a risk by buying a company in order to get into a new market, but you don't have that consolidated community of people just doing something because they love it, even though it's not very sexy, right? So we'll see that again. I mean, I've kind of been on pause for the last year because it's really hard to do anything unique or weird right now because there's too much money available and people just kind of trying to cash in on things. And that's really hard, you know, but it's just a phase. It's a weather pattern, right?
Right.
But a lot of the really, really smart creative people I know, they are having a lot of issues with depression around it because they can't be the creative people they were before. They're just getting offered these these jobs where they just kind of put themselves on hold. I also know a lot of people have committed suicide recently.
Wow.
And it's really upsetting because, you know, they're really amazing people who were good at the kind of organic communities. People like Igal Koshevoy in the Portland tech community, for instance, that was one of the most welcoming people ever. You know, they go away when these things go up. And you know, they show up again if they haven't died, you know, when things go down. And we don't really have a lot of support systems for the people that create these organic communities. And I think it's really important to know that, you know, this is a kind of tribal type thing. In a tribe, you have the people with the stories, the people that are the community people. You have the warriors. You have the people who pass the information on from generation to generation. And we don't have a lot of that right now. And that's why I really try to stay around people that are of lots of different ages, right? Because if we forget the past, and we're just obsessed with creating the future, then we have to rely on things like, you know, science and research and a lot of funding and a lot of mistakes in order to make the next thing, which was originally something that was 30 years old, right? Like Calm Technology. Like, the whole point of Calm Technology is, don't spend $20 million screwing up your product. Read what these people spent $20 million on at Xerox PARC in the 80s and 90s and what they came up with and their conclusions. And then you can learn about what they did wrong and what they did right and save yourself the time. You know, the whole point of looking to history is people already did this before. If you're actually doing something new, then no one's going to support you at all anyway. So have a good time. But if people are interested in it at all, there's a lot of research behind it. And it's important to remember, you know, what people did, even though they might have written something in an obscure journal. In the case of Calm Technology, the papers are up on calmtechnology.com. They're written beautifully. They're so easy to read. They're an example of kind of scientific philosophy that people should be writing more like. It's not pretentious. It's just very simple. It really matches what they were trying to get across. And because Mark Weiser died of cancer suddenly, you know, only about like 20 years ago, he's not around to tell his story. And I really think that every once in a while when I find these people whose stories haven't been told properly, I just want to tell the story because it's really important. I had a CEO of a really large company come up to me after a talk I gave, and he said, you know, if I had read these papers before, we would have saved about $10 million on this project.
And they're available on your website.
Yeah, on calmtechnology.com. Right. And I just spent a whole year trying to put all this down into a book, and that's now available. You can order that on the internet from my Riley Books.
Yeah. What can we talk about? You do have, so the Calm Technology book, Designing for the Billions of Devices and the Internet of Things, that's I saw it's on pre-order now, right?
Yeah. So you can just basically order it and it will show up, but there's also the early release program from Riley.
Okay.
You can read the whole thing right now.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. They do this little thing to get the book out early. So that's, you know, that was really hard because I wanted to make sure to update some of these things for the generation that we're existing in right now. And then also have enough original content that people could get a good understanding. And I think the problem with writing a technical book is, well, is it going to be completely useless in 6 months? You know, the best books last for what, 2,000 years, 5,000 years, right? Like we're still running on a political society that's kind of based on like Plato and Aristotle, right? That's pretty great. Like, there's no way I can write a book that's going to last for 1,000 years. But you know, if it could last for the next five, that'd be great.
That would be great. Yeah. Okay. So. I have two more questions before I cut you loose. I was really interested when I knew I was going to talk to you. I just recently listened to Sam Harris's podcast where he had Max Tegmark from MIT on, and they were talking about AI. We're talking about a lot of things, multiverse, but they came to AI, and it was interesting because it raised a lot of concern. I think they both had concern about AI and what the impending intelligence explosion and how the threat to humanity actually from AI. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that, or what do you think moving forward? Is there a danger in AI?
I love this question. It's great. This may be an unpopular view, but I do think of a lot of technology workers in tech programs as going to be, more of these things are going to be blue collar work in the future. Bruce Sterling gave a keynote at a 2009 Interaction Design Conference in Boulder, Colorado. And he said to a lot of people in the audience, he said, this is an intense thing to say. He said, the reason you guys are all getting paid so much is because you leave behind little legacy, right? where a lot of people are just getting paid to build the next thing, but that thing doesn't really have any lasting value. So I think of AI, I hate the word AI. Artificial intelligence is like saying jumbo shrimp. You know, it's my dad, when I was little, my dad would read me this book called Naturally Intelligent Systems, which is how you could evolve.
Now, there's some bedtime reading.
It was great. Yeah. That and The Evolution of Consciousness.
Wow.
The idea behind these books was that how do you evolve consciousness? How do you evolve a naturally intelligent system? My grandpa worked on AI. My dad worked on AI. A lot of my friends' coworkers worked on early AI, voice concatenation systems, 3D computing and parallel processing, things like that. So, of course, our dinner table conversations every single night were about AI. If you want to read a really great book about an evolving AI, I'm just going to call it a naturally intelligent system, read the book Avogadro Corp by, what is his name? I forgot his name, sorry.
I'll find it and put it in the show notes when I
post
it.
Yeah. Read Avogadro Corp. It's about an artificial intelligence that takes over email networks. It's really great. The threat. It's always this, the threat to humanity. You know, well, okay. Let's go back to the Industrial Revolution. What was the threat to humanity through Industrial Revolution? Well, we had the Wizard of Oz kind of give us a science fiction commentary. The Scarecrow was the farmer in the Midwest. Did he have enough of a brain to compete in the Industrial Revolution? And did the Tin Woodman, the industrial man, have enough of a heart? You know, was his heart eroding? And how could he go find the heart in the middle of machinery? And Dorothy, who was caught up in all of this, you know, living with her Aunt Em and Uncle Henry in the middle of the Dust Bowl, you know, where was she trying to go? Well, she was just trying to find a green utopian land in which everybody had equality, right? You go through the Oz book series, which was published like roughly like 1901 to 1914 before L. Frank Baum died. And you have in book two, the suffrage movement. You have all of these political comments on this land of Oz, right? Through this lens. So when we go to the information society, we're going to have people who don't have particularly predictable work. The Industrial Revolution is all about something fueled by alcohol, where you need to be on time and do a perfect job and do the same thing again and again, where we are very machine-like. In the information society, you can make an entire living being a professional Harry Potter fan.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You can make a living being a World of Warcraft player, right?
Yeah. Yeah, my wife follows one of those professional Harry Potter fans. Just went to an event. Mark Reeds. I don't know if you follow him, but
fantastic, right? Yeah, like there are people now making $5,000 a month making
that, exactly. Yep.
There are people who are live streaming Grand Theft Auto, right?
Yep.
So who could have predicted this? Well, there is a guy named Masuda who was a futurist, and he wrote a book called The Information Society as Post-Industrial Society, and he talked about the information voluntary community as one of these new spaces that you could make money in. It's just this great book, right? So again, I keep going back, you know, the 70s and 80s and looking at what people thought the future would be. Masuda actually took a series of towns in Japan, and he said, let's hook all of the television sets together on a network so that you can not only receive a signal, but send one, and then find out what applications, so to speak, people used. And they did photo sharing. They did online education and learning. They did weather reports. You know, they did all these things. So the Information Society is going to really mess everything up in an even larger way than the industrial society did. But that doesn't mean we're going to not have agriculture, right? It doesn't mean that we're not going to have industry. In the same way that we still have cash, even though we have credit cards, we'll still have all those things. We'll still have AOL subscribers. But for an increasing number of people, very weird lifestyles will start to happen. Instead of a one and a zero, a black and white, we'll have more quantum-like things where maybe some random moment will happen online where you'll get shoved into stardom, or an entire company will be taken down because they said something horrible about somebody else, right? It's going to be weird. We'll have things like Bitcoin and then Dogecoin, and we'll have people getting flown around the world at the drop of a hat for doing something weird on the internet.
Yeah, right.
We'll have cats like little Bub flying first class. And, you know, we're starting to see it. Just a matter of time, right? We're starting to see this. But AI, it's not AI. It's just, hey, do we need to hire somebody for this? No. Okay, we'll automate it, right? How much of things will be automated, right? We're seeing with the Tesla factory, things are being automated. Who are the most useful people in a firm? Well, in the future, it's going to be the people that reduce the amount of time and space to get stuff done, the people who are kind of lazy but really smart, and who write a script that replaces something, who simplify the pieces of a process so that only two people have to work at a company instead of 20. Hmm. What does that mean for labor? That's going to be the question, right? What will we still need? Food service, hospitality, right? We will still need humans more than ever, because at the end of the day, that's who we identify with. Hmm. We don't want to replace everybody at the train station with a computer. Because if your phone is out of battery, or your credit card fails, or you're new to the country and you don't know where to go, you still need somebody to talk to. So this threat of AI is like the threat of Y2K. It's like, okay, come on. Like, there's always these threats, you know. Yeah, right. Are we getting killed by information? Yes. Somebody doing a misdiagnosis because of a robotic system saying this is how much insulin we need to put into the patient in a hospital, that can kill people. Do we have pilots piloting planes that are almost automated entirely and then forgetting how to fly? Yes, right? Now, it's still the safest place to be in the sky. But we're going to have these issues that are more like the movie Brazil, where you say something bad online and it's the wrong name, Tuttle versus Buttle, and you get taken into prison for that without a fair trial, right? We're going to have those issues come about, and I think those are... I'm not going to say far scarier than the Industrial Revolution, because the Industrial Revolution was all about physical things that could happen to you that were horrible, right? Like, oh, you got stuck in the giant loom or the triangle shirt waist factory and everybody dies, right? Those have now shifted from the first world to the third world, right? Now they're all over the place and we don't see them anymore. Just like we kind of ignore polio, except for Bill Gates caring about it a ton, right? So we've taken those out of sight and out of mind, and now our new thing is going to be a crisis of existentialism. What to do when a generation of parents who have had predictable incomes and predictable careers deal with their kids who have co-signed on loans for schools, and they're $80,000 in debt, and there's no clear path for them like their parents grew up with, yet in front of them, they can make movies online and make $5,000 a month.
Yeah, I guess that's where the therapists come in at this point, right?
Right. And I think there might need to be therapists for parents who thought that their kids were just following in their footsteps.
Yeah, right.
But whose kids have no ability to step into the world that their parents were.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to have issues with administrators getting paid a lot of money and not actually doing anything. And I think it's really, really important to look at that for what it is. You know, we might have a kind of lost generation, right? Where, you know, all the people in kind of the hippie generation are like, why aren't the youth of today rising up and saying, what is wrong? Well, they're exhausted. They can't just declare bankruptcy because it'll take their parents down with them. They don't come from a world that won World War II and got all stretchy and utopian for a while in the verbs, right? We don't have the crazy resources we did before. And we don't really have a thing to follow. And when you have nothing to follow, you create, right? And the small group of people that do create in this particular generation, and then the next generation, you know, the internet generation, so to speak, will be really interesting, right? But you know, a lot of parents I know right now is like, hey, my kid's a professional video gamer and he's 13 and the school is angry and they want to expel him. And I said, great, expel him and use the $50,000 a year that your kid is getting paid to hire a private tutor. Yep. He probably doesn't need to go to college. But the question is, what happens in 10 years when that kid is no longer the top video game player? What is he going to do? What happens if a kid peaks at age 10 on YouTube, right? Yeah, right. These are more of the existential depressive questions that happen in the information society. And those are the kind of real threats to our existence, right? It's now information and philosophy and mental. It's the internal space that's getting colonized by corporations. It's not the external space. Wow. And so that becomes really, really interesting, right? It's just a whole slew of edge cases and no longer one size fits all culture. And that's the interesting stuff. So that's really my answer to the AI question, sure. because I hate AI. I like naturally intelligent systems, okay. and it's symbiotic. You know, if we do too much AI, we have big issues about mistreating patients and things like that.
Okay, last question for you, and I'll let you go. I'm also a fan of Kara Swisher's podcast, Recode Decode. And so, and she's always asking all her guests, it seems, and I appreciate this about her, that and they typically tend to be white males, most typically, but she's always asking them about diversity and tech crisis. And you had this really interesting upbringing, and I think you were named, you know, I think it was Wired Magazine, Women to Watch in Tech. And so you've hit some of those lists, but I'm wondering if you have any ideas about kind of this lack of diversity in the tech world and if there's anything that could be done about it, that kind of thing.
Okay, this is going to be a very strange response.
Okay.
Why aren't we talking about diversity in coal mining?
Hmm.
Right? What's the difference?
Hmm.
Okay, yeah, there's a big difference. We have technology and programming, which honestly is a boring janitorial task, although janitorial tasks are actually kind of more interesting when compared to a bunch of people yelling at you about a bug that you can't repeat. You know, where you're getting controlled like a bee in a hive by some manager who doesn't really know anything about the features but keeps causing you to add them in and then pays you a bunch of money thinking that will solve the problems. And then you get so stressed out that you spend all of that money to live in the equivalent of a beehive in San Francisco,
yeah.
right?
Yeah,
is that really a sexy job? Is it not really? You know, there are a few people who craft their code and make it beautiful and do really great things, like John Carmack, one of the people who made a very popular video game, right? We have Notch, who created Minecraft, who is depressed because he's really interested in building things, not making tons of money off of them. And then you have investment makers and VCs and things like that who are basically glorified money managers who come in and they have to return an investment to the fund that they raised.
Right.
Right. So when you found a company, you are beholden to your employees, your customers, your funders, and then the people who fund the funders. Right.
Right.
Like, is anything in there actually sexy and exciting? No, not really.
You don't hear that very often, though. I mean, you're almost there is almost a coal mine aspect to Silicon Valley, right?
Yeah, I owe my soul to the company store, right? The company store is Google, right?
Right, right.
Just kind of like investment bankers on Wall Street. Is that a sexy job? No, gosh, it's 16 hours a day, 20 hours a day. People are killing themselves over this.
So right? you're really interested in getting back to the creative process or the
There's a difference between getting paid as a code monkey,
right,
to do something that you actually hate, that is turned from something that you did for fun on your parents' Sinclair computer to something that is a repetitive task that doesn't mean anything for a company that will ultimately fail after 5 years, that causes people to click buttons and causes them to, you know, go into more depressive loops than they already are in.
Right.
To creating something really interesting, right? Like WordPress, not an accidental project, but everybody was making their own content publishing system in 2003, you know, and Matt Mullenweg's system was one of them. You know, I used the first version of WordPress that was available online in like 2003 to 2004, right? It was a mess. It was awful. It was awesome, you know?
Right.
There's the creative parts. It's more like craft and artistry. And then there is the coal mining. Now, you don't get lung disease, right?
Right.
You don't have the shaft collapse on you, right?
Right.
But maybe you can't maintain relationships with your family. And maybe you're in an identity crisis constantly and you're overwhelmed, right?
Right.
So, lack of diversity. I was pushed into tech all the time as a kid because that's all I knew. That's where I felt safe. I'm weird, right? But there are other people out there that that are taught when they're little that external appearances matter a ton. And it's not what's in your head, it's how you present. And I noticed that, like, for instance, a lot of women were totally about that around me, and I couldn't interface with them because I didn't have the right clothes. And so I was shunned by them most of my life. And now I see people are like, I want to get into tech. I'm like, why? Because externally it looks sexy. They're like, yeah, it's great. No. Like, you want to get into it because it's weird and allows you a sense of like power and excitement and that like little voice in the back of your head that says, wow, this is the most incredible thing ever. I wonder if I can do this, right?
Yeah.
So most people are going to hate me for those answers, right? But it's really important to note what is tech and what is a tech job and what does it really mean before saying, oh no, there's a lack of diversity.
Yeah,
right?
I think that's a really interesting point that what are we really aspiring to, right? And so, and maybe that is the first step. Let's really take a closer look at what this involves, and maybe that doesn't get critiqued too much, right?
Right, because there are a lot of, you know, it's a lot of this, the structure of the system. Being a programmer and being a nerd was the worst thing you could be. I was told by my parents to be careful not to be an egghead.
Mm.
They taught me some scripts that I could talk to people with. How was your weekend? How are you doing?
Yeah.
So that I didn't come off as a completely insensitive jerk. So that I could be more human-like. But in reality, I was just interested in what I could make a computer do and interested in how people worked. And so I wasn't going to make a lot of friends, right? And so for that type of person, like, this job makes a lot of sense to me. Caring about interfaces and how people interact with them, yeah, you know, it's dull, boring stuff to most people. But right now, all these people are trying to learn how to code because they think it's going to empower them to make a lot of money. And it might. It might empower them,
right?
But you have a lot coming up against you if you're raised in an environment in a lower class community that might be racially diverse, but when everybody at school makes fun of you for trying to get good grades or makes fun of you for trying to program or doesn't have access to enough technology,
right?
Or if you're, or if you happen to identify as female and, females will not be your friends because you don't dress the proper way, right?
Right.
It's kind of built into a system where, what, you know, why are you trying to become a programmer? If you're having a great time with a computer in your own free time, great. But if you're not, then oh no. And the way in which women and men are taught often is that a guy will keep trying something even if it fails and blame it on the world if it doesn't work, and a woman will blame it on herself and give up, right?
Right.
So when I watch women try to learn how to program, they say, oh, I'm bad at this. And then, like, I watch a guy and he's like, the computer sucks. Or hide the fact that they've been trying something for 16 hours and it hasn't worked. And they only show when they have done something that worked, right?
Yeah.
And I know that because I don't show all the times that it's been really hard for me to do things. I just show the epic part, right? So it looks like I'm really good because you don't see the parts before,
right?
So what people are doing is, you know, they're hiring somebody that's programmed since age of six. You know, they're hiring somebody that has made a lot of mistakes for fun. And then somebody tries to learn it from scratch. It's like, well, you've got about 8 years of making mistakes and thinking you're horrible first. And a lot of people that I've hired, a lot of people I've worked with, even though they might look like macho people, which is a weird thing to say about people in tech, they aren't. They're always self, you know, freaking out about whether they're okay at something or not.
Right.
Even the ones that are really good.
Lots of insecurity floating around in the tech world. Yeah.
They have to change whatever language they're learning constantly. Yeah. Like, oh no, now I've got to learn Go. Oh no, now I got to learn this. Or, ooh, Go, cool, I'm going to learn it, right?
Yeah.
It's one of the weirdest places, and a lot of people get burnt out, and then they can't work after 40. There's a lot of ageism. That's another really big issue. You know, guys are getting plastic surgery to look younger so that they can continue to work. And then, you know, if you don't make your life's amount by, like, age 40 or go into management, which a lot of programmers don't want to go into because they enjoy coding, then what are you going to do with your life? Right? So we're going to see a lot of these issues come to the forefront. There are a lot of guys there, but a lot of the guys originally were the people that didn't get along and were shunned by a lot of people. And now we have a lot of people going into it because it's interesting. And now nerds are considered cool, which I still don't believe in that. That's the weirdest thing ever. Yeah. And we're seeing a lot of people come in, not because they want to, but because they think it's a great thing to do. And once they get in there, they're like, oh God, what am I doing? I'm so depressed.
Right.
So there is a lack of diversity, but it's because of how people are raised and how people are socialized.
Mm. For sure. Yep.
Yeah.
All right. So how would our listeners find, how would they find you on the web? And I'm going to put this in the show notes as well, but you have a couple of websites. Would you give us the address so they can track you down?
Sure. If you're not angry enough about what I just said about random generalizations of people, then you can follow me online at Case Organic on Twitter, caseorganic.com, Case Organic on Instagram, and calmtechnology.com. And you can get the book from O'Reilly or Amazon.com.
Yeah, perfect. And Amber, I want to really thank you for coming on and taking some time. This has always been a fascinating conversation for me, and I look forward to continuing to watch what you do and with much interest. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Yep. Thanks.
Bye.
Well, that's our show. As always, I want to thank you for listening. Like I said previously, you can get a hold of me through the email, theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. The website is theradicaltherapist.com, and we have an Instagram and Twitter site. The Twitter site is the Rad Therapist, and the Instagram site is The Radical Therapist. And you can interact with us in all different ways. And as always, we really like your feedback. Shoot me an email. Let me know how we're doing. And I think most importantly, probably go to iTunes and subscribe and rate and review the show, please. Rate and review the show. I guess that keeps us on the radar, and I would like to continue to do that. So please do that. So one more time, I just want to thank Amber Case for coming on the show. She was really flexible about just making time for the show, and and I know she's very busy, and I just really appreciate her making that effort. So, and I really enjoyed talking with her. So my name is Chris Hoff. This has been The Radical Therapist, and thanks for listening.